96 years is not a bad innings if you're using a cricketing metaphor. Even better if you can get to the 100 and start a century. And that is really at the heart of what we're going to be looking at over the next 45 minutes or so when we start talking about the British Broadcasting Corporation, as we refer to it now and have referred to it since 1927. There are a number of key names we'll be talking about as the session proceeds, including Ellen Wilkinson. Anybody know who Ellen Wilkinson is? Was? Oh, that's okay then. John Reith, as you can see on line there, in terms of was he a self-styled pioneer of broadcasting, somebody who had a passion, a commitment to what broadcasting should be, and also how news and talks developed within the BBC through the 1930s, and actually how in its early inception the word journalism was a very bad word to utter when you spoke to BBC executives. It was not something that they saw themselves as basically being wanted to connect with, because it was seen as a sordid, grubby profession, and the BBC should be better than that. And we'll go on to consider about how the BBC might well, over the years, started finding its voice, how it certainly manifested itself as part of the overall communications network during the Second World War, and has kind of been with us ever since. As I say, 96 years, not a bad innings. Will we reach a stage where we mourn the loss of the BBC, or will it still have a part to play as we head through the 21st century? Well, we've certainly come on quite some time since the original radio sets were being developed at the start of the 20th century, where we were looking very much at the ways in which the telegraph could be used and developed, not only to transmit signals and various SOS dot 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 Morse code packages, but actually could transmit and receive sound. Interestingly enough, there was also talk about transmitting visual images as well. And for those people who think, oh, television came long after radio, it was kind of being exhibited and demonstrated in the Paris World Fair in 1900 that visual images were developing. But it just took a little bit longer to open up how television evolved and so on. John Logie Baird and Marconi were the two key pioneers when it came to television, both working in the 1920s and 30s. And finally, Marconi effectively won out with his slightly more sophisticated line system, which was developed as well, providing a television set for Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister, in 1930, in which he could actually speak to other nations. Interestingly enough, the early aspects of television can be seen very much as similar and analogous to Skype. Television was never viewed in its early days as being a broadcast medium to mass audiences like radio, but television was seen as basically being a one-to-one way of actually communicating with the televisor, visual images over large distances. So the likelihood would be that MacDonald, indeed, as he said in his notes at the time, could communicate with other aspects of the British Empire from far away using the televisor medium and so on. Pretty soon afterwards, though, when people realised, much as with most visual images, that you could also have entertaining programmes and various other aspects on there, television also developed a working schedule. And effectively, if you look at the schedules that were being provided for television in the home counties in the 1930s, they were covering things which had the familiar genres of cooking programmes, of do-it-yourself guides, of variety, musical aspects, numbers, and so on. Not necessarily identical to what we've got today, and certainly with one exception, i.e. how to build your own bomb shelter, there was a variety of other aspects that we could recognise as being part of the basic building blocks of television and so on. But television was yet to come, and Reith was not really a fan of television in the 30s. Various lines have come across in terms of what he actually thought about television, but I think he was so disheartened with the test between Marconi and John Logie Baird that he could never quite sort of see it as being the ideal way forward. It wasn't really until Reith had left the BBC in 1937 that television started developing for a short period before war broke out, and effectively television ceased transmission in Britain to enable people who worked in the television industry with the BBC to move on to the development of radar and other key aspects. but any self-styled respecting home within the 1920s and 30s would have, as part of the family entertainment package, lower middle class, and upper class families, the radio set. The radio set, which would be seen as very much something which, unlike the newspaper, which had been around consistently for, again, 200 years. I mean, if we actually look at, very briefly, some of the dates of national newspapers, the Times launched in 1785. Sunday newspapers such as The Observer emerged in 1791. So pretty much well over a century and a half, the newspapers had had clear dominance in what we would refer to as the beginnings of the mass media age. And television was one of the, radio was one of the sort of elements which started beginning to challenge that dominance in the 1920s and 30s. Sometimes to the concern of the newspaper owners, who were obviously concerned that this thing called television, called radio, could actually prevent people from buying newspapers. Why would you want to buy newspapers if you could actually listen to the news being read out to you? And there were various constraints that were deliberately put into place in the early days of licensing the BBC, which prevented the BBC actually running news bulletins prior to 7 o'clock in the evening, and even only then, short 2 and 3 minute news bulletins. So again, there were politics was at work, as we'll see. And again, by the time we get to certainly the 1930 period, the traditional wireless set are beginning to emerge as standard practice in most homes and so on. So let's talk you through some of the timelines and some of the key things that developed in the early establishment of the BBC. Before we look at how the national press was responding to the BBC, let's look at how things were developed. Well, bear in mind that at this time we also had extensive development of broadcasting and radio broadcasting in America. Many British politicians were concerned that we could be faced in Britain with what they referred to as the chaos of the airwaves. In other words, if you had the money, you could buy a license to have your own radio station and continue broadcasting, funded by commercials, until such time as either you went bankrupt or it just didn't suit your particular business plan, etc. And there was a sense that actually we didn't want to have the British entry into radio to follow that pattern. But equally, there was concern that they didn't want to simply produce a radio service, a mass broadcasting media service, which would simply replicate what you would have got in the Soviet Union, which was basically a completely state-controlled, state-operated broadcasting service, which meant you didn't have any other viewpoint other than that which the government, elected or unelected, effectively put forward. One view, one side, Pravda, truth, one way only. So, as you might imagine, we have this opportunity to really set up a kind of fudge. And the British Broadcasting Company was formed originally in 1922 as a kind of response to demonstrating that it had the responsibility, it had the maturity to develop this. Now, as with most organisations, we grow, we build, we develop. And let's consider the work of John Reith. Reith was a Scottish individual. He was the first managing director of the British Broadcasting Company. Adjectives which have been used by Asa Briggs to describe Reith in his history of the BBC include: he was harsh, he was ruthless, he was determined, and he certainly had a very solid morality. He was a Scots Calvinist individual. And he had also been wounded in World War I. He'd done service for his country in the Great War, as referred to, and he clearly had a passion to effectively develop this whole thing called broadcasting. It is undeniable that Reith coined the phrase to inform, to educate, and to entertain. And allowing for those three aspects, I would have thought hope, perhaps, that very few people have concerns with: information, education, entertainment. And on that basis, he was part of that group that effectively said, okay, let us form this British Broadcasting Company to deal with radio broadcasting. And originally it was formed on the basis of the licenses that were developed or that were sold to have a radio set. well up until 1950s, 1960s, in order to actually listen to your radio, you had to have a radio license. That was then amalgamated in the 1950s to the TV license, which encompassed both, which it does to the present day. But if you had a radio set and you were using radio, you had to have a license to listen to it. So you couldn't buy a radio set without a radio license, and it was a percentage of that which came to actually fund the BBC. Okay? Other aspects that were used to refer to refer to John Reith included the fact that he was pompous, he was humourless, he was arrogant, he was paranoid, he was self-pitying, and even his daughter said he was an anti-Semitic individual. Undoubtedly, Reith was autocratic and he was intimidating. He was a tall individual who effectively would sort of dominate on the basis of conversations and a whole variety of things. And he was very much responsible behind the BBC being centralised in London. He maintained that if it was the British Broadcasting Corporation, we couldn't be doing without skirts such as Birmingham, such as Newcastle, such as Edinburgh and so on. It had to be centralised in London to basically sort of have that centrist aspect. And from his own perspective, it was very much a case of if you didn't get on with Reith, effectively you could be exiled to the north, the ultimate in Korea. Suicide and so on. As is often the case with respect to British developments, there were a number of commissions that were commissioned and arranged by Parliament to address the issues related to the BBC, the first of which was the Sykes Commission. And that is a really critical recommendation that we've put on there. It was a recommendation that the state should regulate, so effectively have overall control of what was deemed acceptable, but it shouldn't be an operator for the broadcasting system. A year later, the Crawford Committee actually suggested that this should be seen as a public corporation which would act as a trustee for the nation. So no commercials, and a station which would be set up to effectively cover interests, but would be commercial free as well. And also because by then, by 1925, the British Broadcasting Company had already been in operation for 3 years, there was a suggestion that that should actually be a natural sort of policy to actually hand the system over to the BBC, and that could actually develop its own routine. Why have I actually put in the 1926 general strike? Well, not only to give me a chance to mention Ellen Wilkinson, who was a Labour MP for Middlesbrough, but also to address the way in which John Reith actually played what can best be seen in hindsight as real politics. The BBC took a very, very neutral view of the general strike. In fact, actually, many critics have said that they were very much in favour of the government at the time. Now, Reith's rationale for that was, well, the government in Parliament are elected by the people. We in the BBC are meant to represent and reflect the people, therefore we take the voice of the government, therefore we're not going to basically focus on the general strike. So huge issue there, ideologically, in terms of what could and could not be reported, which created a lot of concern with respect to the BBC. Now, the line that Reith was going for was to begin to appease newspaper owners, newspaper magnates and so on, who didn't want the BBC to be covering news. They wanted that kept completely separate and kept under their own domain. And ultimately, there was an argument that actually this was a way in which the BBC would get a bit more freedom to actually develop. In actual fact, it meant the end of the whole thing. They were allowed to broadcast slightly longer bulletins, lasting half an hour, still restricted to nothing before 7 p.m. on a day, so well after all the newspapers had sold and been delivered and so on. And again, restricted primarily to what was referred to as the talks department. And ways forward. So again, any notion of actually having investigative journalism in any sense was not seen as being part of the British Broadcasting Company's remit and so on. And Reith didn't have any problems with that because he maintained he was looking for the high culture, the notion of actually going beyond the notion of falsifying facts and various other bits and pieces. Clearly, folk in favour of the general strike, folk actually sort of really concerned about the whole thing, such as our Labour MP for Middlesbrough, Ellen Wilkinson, were very incensed about this. And Ellen actually wrote to the Radio Times, effectively saying she was going to send back her license fee. She was annoyed with the whole sort of aspect. There were a whole range of other issues in terms of it clearly was not in keeping with objective reporting, because you're only getting one side of the story. You're getting the side of the factory workers. Sorry, you're getting the side of the factory owners. You're getting the side of the establishment, the government. You're not getting the side of the people who are actually on the strike. And there was a notable absence of any reporting in terms of that. So in the first, some might say, real test of whether it was going to be a genuine reporting organisation, the BBC took a very biased view. As I say, it was a gamble. Some might say, well, it paid off. They did actually, they were allowed to actually become the British Broadcasting Corporation as opposed to the British Broadcasting Company. And as a result of that, established Broadcasting House and moved into a whole brave new world. As I say, 96 years later, here we are talking about how the things developed and so on. Now, the BBC was primarily supposed to always be a business. Whether it was, I mean, the clue is in the name, really, British Broadcasting Company. 5 years as the British Broadcasting Company, the rest of the time as the British Broadcasting Corporation. It needs to generate an income. That comes from licence fees and maybe any other areas. It's not coming from commercial sales, as I say. It's not a commercial-based thing. It comes from licence fees. It may come from other sources, again, as things are developed. But for Reith, he sees it very much as a crusade. He sees it very much as a way in which broadcasting should be above politics. There should be a range of aspects that should develop to educate and inform. And so the initial employees of the BBC with respect to talks programmes would be developing their own particular strategies, featuring speakers of the day, George Bernard Shaw and others who would come in and effectively broadcast for 20, 25 minutes about a particular topic of the time. That's fine. But was there any censorship involved in that? Well, actually, yes, there was. But in traditional BBC formatted style, this wasn't overt censorship. This wasn't censorship in terms of you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. This was basically censorship which could best be described as death by committee. If you wanted to actually have a particular broadcast developed for the BBC, you would have to submit an idea, a programme proposal. That idea would go through at least two, possibly three committees to determine whether it was viable in the first place, including audience, including what the intentions were, including whether it was suitable and so on. If it was then greenlit, it would then move to another phase in which it would effectively require a producer to be assigned to it, to be developed, to look at who was going to actually be doing the talking. And there are lots of examples. You can look online, you can see history of the BBC, where comments are made such as, well, the voice is a little bit dull, it's a bit tired, it doesn't enthuse people, it doesn't connect together. Ways in which subtleties were put together basically say, just don't do it. So if you go through all those phases, you've really got to be passionately committed to jump through all of those hurdles which were in place if you wanted to get your own particular viewpoint across. On the other hand, if you are very much of the belief that the BBC should be celebrating the best of culture, that classical music, that chamber music, that key elements of Britishness should be developed, that's not really a challenge. That can be developed, that can be put forward. And this is where we see the beginnings in the 1930s, 1940s of the representation element. How the BBC effectively represents us, repackages the whole notion of what it is to be British. Brands that they used a few years ago was My BBC. How that sort of connects all of us, that universality and so on. Certainly, if you're looking for diversity, there's not a great deal in the cast of Bandwagon in 1938. Highly popular programme, but again, very much focused on the kind of middle class, upper middle class environment and line from that point of view. Interesting enough, when war did break out in 1939, there was a feeling that the BBC needed to be very sombre, be very solemn, and there was a lot of debate in terms of should we just play classical music and just work that, or should we actually start reflecting the nation and so on? And we'll hear in a few seconds one of the examples of the elements that came through that. A line that's taken from this particular cartoon, Again, you can look at it online because the slides are all on Blackboard, but the strap line is funny. I could have sworn that was a regional cough. You know, you're very much looking at home county's accent, received pronunciation. Any accents that aren't received pronunciation are usually delivered for comedic effect. So you're basically laughing at people, laughing at the working classes and so on, and a whole range of elements within that. And that whole essence of local and regional broadcasting was something which became a kind of separate entity within that. Now, it's wrong to say that women were not part of the BBC, because clearly they were, even after the war. But mostly in terms of secretarial positions, support positions, and so on. To actually develop in terms of a programme leading role was something which was a huge challenge. Not necessarily completely insurmountable, but still difficult to work through, and so on. And again, you know, it's always interesting looking at some of the sort of political cartoons and satirical things that come through from that point of view. Say, Mr. Ambassador, don't be too depressing with your European crisis, because I follow you with, we're all going on the rickety-rackety-razzle. Again, this notion of talks, lines that come through the BBC, if you want to talk about the world as it is, and remember, we've had a depression, we've got huge issues with respect to mass unemployment, we had a general strike in the 1930s, you've got abdication. Should the BBC report the abdication? Really significant question marks in terms of, was it right to do so, was it not right to do so, how things should develop, how it should be taken on that sort of basis, how are these things being represented and developed, were very much at the heart of what the BBC was all about. But things were changing. When Reith left in 1937 to join British Airways, the first record that was actually played on the BBC was Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf. There was a way in which things were beginning to move. We had with Richard Dimbleby, father of Jonathan Dimbleby and David Dimbleby, the first live outside broadcast where he reported on the burning of Crystal Palace, or the burning down of Crystal Palace, where it caught fire, reporting, phoning in from a telephone box. So the sense of outside broadcast development was beginning to enhance and develop. And then as we actually head through the war years, we come through that part where actually the BBC in many ways started beginning to earn its corn. As in this broadcast from the writer J.B. Crosley.
And to my mind, what was most characteristically English about it? So typical of us, so absurd and yet so grand and gallant that you hardly know whether to laugh or to cry when you read about them, was the part played in the difficult and dangerous embarkation, not by the warships, magnificent though they were, but by the little pleasure steamers. We've known them and laughed at them, these fussy little steamers, all our lives. We've called them the shilling six. We've watched them load and unload their crowds of holiday passengers, the gents full of high spirits and bottled beer, the ladies eating pork pies, the children sticky with peppermint rock. Sometimes they only went as far as the next seaside resort, but the boldest of them might manage a channel crossing to let everybody have a glimpse of Boulogne. They were usually paddle steamers, making a great deal more fuss with all their churning than they made speed. And they weren't proud, for they let you see their works going round. They liked to call themselves queens and belles. And even if they were new, there was always something old-fashioned, a Dickens touch, a mid-Victorian air about them. They seemed to belong to the same ridiculous holiday world as Pierrots and Piers.
Okay, so a slight regional accent. Clearly a period which, as those of you who've seen the Christopher Nolan movie will be aware, was one in which, in essence, things were really looking difficult for Britain within the global stage. And obviously Dunkirk, whether it was a huge success in terms of managing to rescue as many troops as possible, or whether it was, again, our finest hour, who knows? But still that's being reported and developed and taken through to the nation. And clearly Churchill's speeches, very much at the heart of the BBC's output. And also from a propagandist point of view, we looked a few weeks ago at newsreels, at how Humphrey Jennings and company were kind of promoting the British wartime effort to encourage the involvement of the United States as well. Likewise, with respect to radio, elements coming across. And then in terms of other sort of programmes that are coming through, we're getting the beginnings of light variety programmes with a variety of folk coming together. but still that Reithian aspect of information, education, and entertainment developed, as in this example from the Brains Trust.
This question comes from aircraft woman Alice Jones in the web. She says, lately I've come across a word new to me. The word is allergic. Someone says he's allergic to tomatoes, for instance. Exactly what does allergic mean? Jones?
Basically, it's a compound word derived from two Greek words. One is the word ergon, meaning work, and the other was probably the Greek word elos, meaning other. And it means, therefore, working against or working in a different sense from, or in modern terminology, reacting against, because your work is other than the work of the thing against which you are reacting.
Campbell?
The Americans use the word rather as a slang word. They say allergic to tomatoes, for instance, meaning that they upset you. I know a person, for instance, who can't eat strawberries, comes out in bright red spots. I know another man, a bald-headed chap, when he eats marmalade, the top of his head begins to steam.
It's always dreadful if you do have an allergy to marmalade and your head steams when it actually starts working. It's not to be advised in any way, shape or form. But the BBC is gradually beginning to loosen up. By this stage, of course, it's 20 years old. Okay, we're in the Second World War, but we're beginning to open that whole process through. Post-war, 1946, we see the return of television, and the British Broadcasting Company can then re-embrace television, and the apocryphal tale that the Mickey Mouse cartoon that actually was suspended halfway through in 1939 when war was declared was picked up again in 1946 with an apology for the slight interruption. There are also certain standards in terms of the programming that are maintained, in terms of interludes, in terms of ensuring that people were aware that the BBC as a company was responsible to a whole range of other elements. You can see in terms of that early BBC board, there's John Reith, of course, centre stage, as you'd expect. Again, entrusted with that responsibility of broadcasting and working through its responsibilities as well. And, again, the notion of how the radio, in this presumably posed photograph of the family with their gas masks at the ready, all tuning in for the latest in wartime news and so on. By this stage, of course, the BBC had also managed to have three separate radio services. The Home Service, which was very much the equivalent of what we now regard as a mixture of sort of Radio 4, possibly Radio 5 Live. The Light Programme, which would have been Radio 1, Radio 2. And the Third Programme, which would have been the classic Radio 3 and so on. Again, that split occurred into the current sort of Radios 1, 2, 3 and 4. Five and Five Live didn't get established until the 1980s. That occurred in 1967 with the advent of Radio 1 for reasons that actually I can happily go into if you choose to do the Journalism Histories option with me in the second year when I talk about the pirate radio impact of broadcasting as well. Fun fact though, the original amount that the BBC had in a budget to set up its original service in 1922, £60,000, exactly the same amount as we had when we set up Siren Radio in 1997. Anyway, I thought it was a fun fact. Alexander Palace was the base of television production for an awfully long time. Alexander Palace was the centre of where television production actually occurred, even when it was shut down in the Second World War. But television is still very much an agency which requires a lot of technology. It's not simply a case of getting your mobile phone and shooting whatever you wish. You've got camera crews. You've got a variety of other things to slot into place. You've got lots of heating for lights and so on. And again, in terms of what's being developed, how newsreaders are presenting themselves, how reporters and presenters put themselves forward on screen, changes are developing and working through that. Let's consider a few basic facts, though, in terms of radio and its growth. And it's worthwhile noting that I think it's probably only the smartphone that's actually had similar existential growth in recent history. In 1922, when the BBC launched, there was one radio licence for every 100 households in Britain. One radio licence in every 100 households. By the time we actually got to 1939, there were 71 licences in every 100 households, which basically meant we had moved over the course of 17 years from 36,000 licenses to 8.9 million. So again, we were number crunching a bit last week with respect to the other growth. Radio, huge leap, 36,000 licenses to 8.9 million licenses. And because clearly you had to have a license to legally listen to the radio, those are kind of fairly standard verifiable facts that are actually out there. But I said at the start I was going to talk a bit about newspaper owners. And newspaper owners, as you'd expect, had significant political influence. Clearly, because they can encourage people to vote one way or another, they're reporting a version of the truth and so on. And they did persuade Parliament, as I mentioned, to restrict the newly formed BBC's ability to broadcast any news at all initially. They didn't want to actually have news on there. So that meant, as I mentioned, that the BBC's first licence to broadcast, which is renewed on a fairly regular basis, where people talk about licence renewal and why that's an important aspect. The first licence to broadcast quite clearly stated that BBC news reports were to be strictly limited to news summaries, and they could only be broadcast after 7 p.m. on an evening. Again, simply because they didn't want to have any impact on newspaper sales of the day. Now, clearly from that proviso, it was clear that the radio industry was worrying the newspaper industry. This wasn't like newsreels where you could actually have some media conglomerates actually buying into newsreels and so on. This was something that was seen as separate and also a threat to them. Last week, Jason asked the question, who actually still reads newspapers, who actually has a physical newspaper? You remember the result. Very few, myself, probably sole on that basis. So we have a similar fear that's manifesting in the 1920s, that actually on that basis alone, suddenly radio, not good. If you then add on to the whole notion television, would that be seen also as a threat to British national newspapers in the early days of its mass popularity, in particular the 1950s, with this event, the coronation, 1953, huge impact, because it got people effectively connected. It also meant that you could also watch a major event, the coronation of a new monarch, live as it was happening. Almost as exciting as Princess Eugenie's wedding, or not, as the case may be. ITV actually had bigger audience figures than they thought for that, apparently. Which is fine. Anybody watch it? Oh, well, there you go. And then, of course, Pippa Middleton announces that she's having a baby, and people forget once again about Princess Eugenie all over again. It's just, and Meghan as well. Unbelievable stuff. So how did the press actually begin to deal with this notion, not only of radio, which they kind of, by the time we got to the 1950s, they thought, okay, radio is going to be here to stay, we can cope with that. How can we actually cope with respect to television? Well, let's look again some of the numbers as far as television. Television services in Britain started primarily in 1936. They transmitted to a small area in what would probably be seen now as Greater London. As I mentioned, it didn't really start in earnest until after the Second World War. But then, as a device, you thought radio was big, television vastly outmanned that. It sold faster than any other consumer item in the history of the 20th century. By 1954, half of the households in the United States of America had one television set, and a quarter of all households in Britain had a television set. Now, mostly they were owned by middle-class households. And the first mass televisual event was, as mentioned, the Queen's coronation. 20.5 million people were watching that, which is 56% of the adult population at the time. Now, it's also worth noting, if we're comparing like with like, or similar things, that the Coronation Day edition of the Daily Mirror sold 7.1 million copies more than any other British daily had actually sold before or since. So clearly, people were still using both forms of media. And the BBC also had a monopoly. So, as we said, it was the British Broadcasting Company, one service for three radio stations, and one service for one television station. But then finally that monopoly was broken. It was broken in 1955. It was broken by the advent of the Independent Television Commission and the ITV. The notion that you could actually apply a situation whereby, for once, the American model of actually having television which would be funded by advertising, could be taken on board with certain constraints and certain key elements in terms of Britain. It's interesting that commercial radio doesn't start in Britain until the 1970s. So you still had that reluctance to actually make radio broadcasting, radio advertising present until we got to literally the 1970s, partly as a result of pirate radio, but again, other issues relating that as well. Let's consider news. News on television was pretty problematic during the 1950s. There was a daily news programme which began to appear from 1954 on the BBC, and it was entitled the News and Newsreel Programme. The News and Newsreel Programme. Remember what I talked about with respect to newsreels and documentaries. Newsreel is now beginning to move over into television as a format. Is it news? Well, after a fashion, perhaps. Does it actually reflect the sort of range of views? Perhaps. Again, the BBC, which was always fearful of being accused of political bias, back to the general strike, sought to be as uncontroversial as possible. It didn't want to wreck people's views and senses, etc. So what did they actually do? Well, between 1944 to 1957, the BBC implemented what became known as the 14-day rule. The 14-day rule. Now, that effectively meant that the BBC agreed not to extend its coverage to issues relevant to anything that was being discussed in the House of Commons or the House of Lords for 14 days before they were being debated. So 2 weeks, you couldn't actually talk about anything that was likely to come up in Parliament. Big problem if you're looking for current, contemporary news and so on. Newspapers, no such problem whatsoever. So as far as newspapers were concerned, a real opportunity to produce unrivaled political coverage, because anything you're going to see on the BBC is going to be a fortnight out of date when it comes to politics. Clearly, critics of television voiced their approval of TV news because it wasn't new, it wasn't current. One of the definitions of news is it needs to be working, it needs to be current and contemporary. And the Observer's television critic at the time noted the following: the sad fact has to be recorded that news on television does not exist. What has been produced nightly onto the TV programmes is a little bulletin of news flashes composed of an announcer's voice, a caption, and an indifferent still photograph. This may pass as news, but it does not begin to be television. There was even a concern about having in-vision announcers because you didn't want personalities being associated with the news. By mid-1955, the BBC's television news bulletin was composed of 10 minutes of news read by an off-screen male voice, accompanied by a series of still pictures. These interludes, which are great for looking at if you access them on YouTube, we might actually start off a couple of seminars next week with them. They were literally things like the potter's wheel, the windmill. There were ways in which you'd actually have a natural break, such as between 5 to 6 in the evening and 6 p.m. in the evening, in order to put the children to bed, and so on and so forth. Again, these things had also emerged from early days in radio broadcasting, where there'd be specific pauses at the end of programmes to effectively allow the audience time to reflect, time to move on, and so on. It was a deliberate aspect that was put together. So why did the BBC actually not allow newsreaders to be on camera until September 1955? And even in September 1955, when newsreaders were first seen on camera, we weren't allowed to know their names. Well, according to the BBC, and you could say this is an interesting adjunct from the work of John Reith and so on, the danger of personalising the news as the voice of an individual, as opposed to the British Broadcasting Corporation, was considered to be so serious that you needed to have anonymity. And the emergence of the newsreader personality and a slightly less formal approach to broadcast news coverage only came about because of what was happening with ITV and the Independent Television Network, or ITN News, in September 1955, who, in direct contrast with the BBC's anonymous newsreaders, were given the freedom not only to actually have their names on screen, but also to rewrite the news which would suit their own personal style, even to the extent of including the funny bit at the end, the belated item, which is kind of a quirky bit of news as well. So what impact did that emergence of television news in the 1950s and indeed early 1960s have upon newspapers? Well, again, many in the newspaper industry were very concerned. This is not just news, it's news with pictures and so on, and moving pictures, We can't compete with that. We're not newspapers that are like Harry Potter's newspapers and they have moving images. Obviously, Harry Potter hadn't been written then, but I'm asking you to take a leap of faith. In terms of that, we also had the notion of the health of the newspaper industry. How well was it? This thing which had been in operation for over 200 years, was it still going to survive? And people were so concerned that a royal commission was set up in 1961 to look after the press and how things were going. Some of the figures. Between 1949 and 1961, there were 17 daily and Sunday national newspapers published and four new titles that were actually started. The newspapers, though, that had been mostly affected by television were the mid-market newspapers. Those in the sector which we currently refer to as being occupied today by the Daily Mail, by the Daily Express, again, lots of challenges with respect to that. And the two biggest casualties of the area, of the zone, were probably the News Chronicle, which ended in 1960, and the Daily Herald, which ended in 1964. So why, in particular, those two newspapers? Well, partly because commercial television prompted quicker news and more speedy news, and it basically meant that from that point of view, the tables had been turned, that actually news was coming to the screens and people were finding out about it before the newspapers. The newspapers would be reporting the day after because of print schedules, lag, etc., whereas you were getting current live reporting from that side of things. Curiously, though, red-top tabloids like the Daily Mirror took a slightly different view, and they adopted much more the stance of focusing on entertainment, embracing the perceived enemy, running features on celebrities, running features on stars like Michael Wise and other fine entertaining folk. People who are so well known to the general public, half the population watching them regularly on television, etc., that stories about their own background, sports stars, sporting heroes, the growth very much of celebrity culture. Even celebrity culture, which actually deals with the game show, the talent show, all of these things which have worked well, beginning to generate large audiences in terms of viewing figures, crossing over and then used on a multi-platform way in the news industry to say, well, you've watched so-and-so on screen, what about their private lives, and so on and so forth. This is very much why Rupert Murdoch developed that whole essence of the Sun newspaper, which again opened up that whole sense of the newspaper as popular, super saw away Sun, and so on. And many newspaper owners were quick to see the potential of television, and particularly commercial television, because this is a different aspect of the ecological landscape. This is where television can be developed into a whole range of things and open up ways of enhancing people's appreciation of the news and starting to reflect people across the class system, across the gender system, and so on. So that mass media form of moving images is really working very closely together. If you bear in mind that commercial television was owned by newspapers to the tune of around about 40%, with Associated TV or ATV in the Midlands being one of those things, you got the beginnings of that close relationship between commercial television and the newspapers. Sky emerges, obviously in the 1980s, 1990s and so on, but this ownership of small groups of individuals owning a large group of papers and TV companies, it still occasionally causes concern. And again, we'll discuss why that might be the case. Part of the answer was last week when you talk about multi-conglomerate industries, etc., owning everything. But you're still seeing this whole aspect of how things are being presented and packaged to us. And we are also seeing large-scale numbers of events happening. Quatermass being an example of a science fiction serial that was used very much for the BBC. Colour television emerges in the BBC in the 1960s, as does the third television channel, which is BBC Two, with the Director General of BBC Two there, Hugh Carlton Green, to the fore. This is, in many ways, the golden age of televisual entertainment. Not just news as entertainment, but television in all its forms and shapes and forms. This is the establishment in the BBC of the Wood Lane concrete donut, now demolished and worse through, but again, that whole notion still centralised in London, still actually developing that whole image of a broadcasting governing body, which again has used the sobriquet Auntie Beeb as a way forward. But still beginning to reflect the population in terms of situation comedies like Steptoe and Son, about a rag and bone man, and Father and Son. And also incorporating some of the best talent from the commercial television sector. And indeed, in this gentleman's case, somebody who actually came in from Canada and created the Avengers. Not the Joss Whedon Universe Avengers, but the Avengers with John Steed and Emma Peel. He was also responsible for greenlighting another fairly famous series. Anybody know what it might be? Yes.
It's Doctor Who.
It is Doctor Who, absolutely. And he informed Verity Lambert, who was the first female producer on Doctor Who, first producer on Doctor Who, actually, not just first female producer, that the last thing he ever wanted was for the Doctor to actually be engaging in what he called BEMs, or Bug-Eyed Monsters. After the first four episodes, Unearthly Child and so on, the Daleks emerged. He admitted, when he looked at the overnight figures, that he'd been mistaken about that, because they were phenomenally successful. And we still talk about that, even in a Yorkshire accent, in the 21st century. There were other programmes that were being developed in terms of drama documentaries, in terms of images that we're actually seeing about realistic social conditions at the time. And many people would actually say, at this stage, you've got a golden age of television, because you've got the best of the BBC, you've got the best of ITV, you've got very large-scale budgets, you've got a lot of talent coming through in the whole scenes. We're actually in a week now where it's basically the television festival at MIPCON in Cannes. But things were going to change. Things have changed and adjusted. Some might say for the worse, some might say for the better. But bearing in mind the areas that we've come through, and I'll talk a bit more about Mary Whitehouse, certainly in later sessions and so on, very much one of the founders of the Clean Up Television campaign and the National Viewers and Listeners Association. Right the way through to, again, the commercial kitchen sink drama, again, another long-standing series, television by the stage of the 1960s and 1970s had embedded itself. How did it impact the BBC? Well, the BBC changed. Just as the BBC, if you look at how that changed and evolved to encompass Sky and the various, and BT Sport and various other sort of new sports programmes, they've adjusted, they've kind of evolved. Will it continue to succeed? Will that notion of the BBC under the Reithian philosophy of information, education, entertain, will it continue long into the 21st century? Who knows? Actually, you do, probably, because you'll be determining, in part, how that does develop. Thanks for your time, and I will see you in seminars next week. Make sure you sign the register.